Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Campfire Chronicles. I'm your host, Chris, and this week I will be discussing the topic of what is a ghost with Steve Dills. If you have been listening for a while, you do know who Steve Dills is. He has been on for the Hanover Tavern episodes, and in that episode, we kind of started talking about it, but we had to stop him because it can go on for days. So, without further ado, Steve, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing all right. So, here's the deal. I know that this can be a long, drawn-out process.
This is a very long conversation.
If we hit that hour mark, I'll go ahead and cut you off so that we can turn this into a part one, part two, part 48.
The 10-part series.
Yes. So, for the people that haven't listened, who are you? What do you do? Where do you live? What's your phone number? Instagram, Snapchat.
Social security number.
Yeah. Mother's maiden name.
So my name's Steve Dills. So how is everybody doing? I am the director of a paranormal team called Transcend Paranormal. I am also the president of the board of directors of a wonderful historic tavern called the Hanover Tavern, which is located in Hanover County, Virginia. That is also where I live. But in terms of the paranormal, Transcend Paranormal, we have been operating for over a decade now. And we are a paranormal team that not only assists clients in their homes, their private residences, and their businesses, but we also partner with historic locations. And so one of the things that we do is we host public investigations and lectures, presentations, the whole gamut, as an opportunity for fundraising for these historic sites. So over the last 3 years, we've been able to raise over $90,000 for different historical sites in Virginia, and that's kind of what we do. We're a 15 or so people or person team right now, and so we help folks, we help historical sites, and then we bring on weird folks like Chris to the team. So
yeah, I was gonna say you have a couple pretty cool people on the team. Including myself. So
That's a bold statement.
Yeah. So you're lucky to have me.
It's very bold of you.
So let's get into the meat and potatoes. All right. What is a ghost?
Wow. What? Look at you.
What?
You're not even going to kind of softly get there. Like kind of tiptoe and through the tulips a little bit first.
I mean, you're really,
we're just going straight, right?
I mean, you really can't. Cause like, so you've talked to me a couple of times about it and like, you've mind fucked me pretty good to the point where like, I start questioning a lot of shit and it's like been happening a lot recently. So like, you know, the whole thing is, you know, well, what is a ghost? Well, you know, everyone goes to being, you know, as some dead person. But in theory, it might not be that. So, there's no easy way to kind of transition into that. You just kind of ask, what is a ghost? And you being you, it's gonna just kind of go from there.
I already devolve.
Know. Yeah.
What is a ghost, Chris? What's a ghost?
Well, a ghost can be whatever you want it to be. It could be,
is that right?
Yeah, it could be your dead grandma. It could be like a little like alien from outer space. You know, it could be you from a parallel universe. You never know.
It's interesting. Mm-hmm. So when I say like, what is a coffee cup? Can we say that it's whatever I want it to be?
Yeah, it can be. I mean, it's all in how you portray it to be.
I'm not sure how a rug could be a coffee cup, but
can you walk on it? Can you rub your feet on it?
Yeah, but I'm not going to walk on a coffee cup.
But you can.
Bad decisions.
It doesn't matter if it's bad decisions or not. you can still walk on the item.
So okay.
If you say a coffee cup is a rug.
Well, next time you ask me for a cup of coffee, I will question everything about it. Maybe I'll bring you a rug and I'll just wet it with water. Because in that case, coffee can be anything too, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
If you add in theory to anything, it makes it okay.
Yeah. Okay. Technically correct. The best form of correct, right?
Yeah.
Seriously though, what do you, Christopher Robin, what do you think a ghost is?
Well, before I met you, I kind of fell in line with everyone else that, you know, it's some kind of, like a dead person, obviously, or like something angelic, something demonic, something along the lines of that. But I started kind of questioning all that stuff because I've every single time we go to different places, different stuff like that, it's always like a spirit from 1800s, 1900s. You don't ever see a spirit, rarely ever see a spirit that's of this, you know, time period of the 2000s or 2000, you know, the early 2000s, 2010s, that kind of stuff. So like it kind of starts making you question exactly why is that? So for me personally, I guess beating around the bush, I thought it was a dead person.
Do you think it's intent? Like when you think about it, like a lot of times when people go and investigate, they look at the history of a location. And typically when you're looking at the history, especially here in Virginia, you're focusing on what?
You're focusing on who's been there.
Yeah, but I mean, the biggest event that has occurred in the state of Virginia, in terms of like history and the paranormal, we tend to focus a lot on the Civil War, right? Mm-hmm. That is a huge portion of Virginia history. There's also the Rev War, though. There's the American Revolution all around us. And even before that, there were battles between tribes, Native Americans that were here earlier than us, right? There is a whole slew of things that have occurred. But for whatever reason, we always go into a location, and the first thing we do is we're like, all right, how far back? All right, let's talk to those folks. I mean, we even do that at the tavern. If you pay attention and you're looking at like how we investigate, when we publicly investigate, when we're interpreting, even with the Ghost Walk at Night coming up, we focus very heavily on the Civil War, right? We're talking about the Chisholm family, right? We're talking about diphtheria outbreaks and quarantining. We're talking about Civil War soldiers that stayed there during a period of time, so on and so forth, right? But there was a whole slew of time after that, including the Barksdale Theater in the 1950s. Those people had just as emotional attachments to the building, maybe some even more. So I can tell you that we've interacted with things or entities or spirits that claim to the tavern via the theater, and not necessarily because of the like a war or something like negative emotionally attaching. But we've seen stuff at Henricus. We've interacted with an individual that passed away only a few years back, but he was very passionate about Henricus. So we've seen more recent things, but is it the intent when you go and investigate and the idea of like, okay, I've done my research, I've done my history, I'm focusing on this specific era. And then we all as a collective really like pigeonhole ourselves into only noticing or only trying to communicate with a set era. Therefore, everything else is like, well, they're not interested in talking to me.
Well, I mean, I feel like you should go into a place and have it so that like it's all expanded out. So like you were saying, you know, with the tavern and the Barksdale Theater, you know, it's not something that's negative that keeps them there. It's something that is a positive, something that relaxed them. Maybe they were part of it. Maybe they were happy that, you know, to be there. And, you know, pigeonholing yourself into being like, okay, well, I want to talk to, you know, Colonel Sanders from, you know, the Civil War. Now you're just focusing on that. You know, like you said, I don't know. I never really thought about that way, that, you know, you kind of focus on one and that's it.
Yes. And so if we're going to talk about this for a second, that's why I love a good friend of mine, John Sable. He came down and investigated the tavern before you had started investigating with us. Fingers crossed, we're going to make an announcement real quick for the Hanover Tavern Paracon, which is at Hanover Tavern on January 21st, 22nd. So you heard it here first. John and Mary may be coming down and being a speaker for the Hanover Tavern Paracon. So for those of you that find this next little bit interesting, this is a great opportunity to see them, see the work that they do, because I think it is absolutely phenomenal. John Sable considers himself a ghost excavator. So it's a little bit different than an investigator, right? We investigate, we try to query claims of things, right? John looks at the paranormal in a very unique manner, and I love this idea. And he looks at it as like an onion, right? So it's like we're Shrekifying things, right? We're saying it's an onion. And each piece of history is a layer from that onion, right? The deeper you go towards the core, the older and older and older and further back you get in history, right? And so as investigators, we tend to just go in and we just try to find anything we can. And if we land on a layer, we just stay there because that's what we're getting interactivity on, right? Like, okay, we're getting activity. Let's stay here. Let's continue asking questions about this significant or this particular event. What John does is he looks at the big picture of a location, of the history of a location, including recent history. Yesterday is history. 30 seconds ago is history, right? So he's looking at history as a whole, not just, okay, I'm looking at the big significant events that occurred at this location. He's looking at everything. And he's peeling it back like an onion. He's excavating. And so what he's going to do is he'll look at this whole big picture, and he will build what he calls scenes that I don't want to say reenact, but it's a great word. He's going to reenact a day in the life. So it might be that when you're looking at the Hanover Tavern, a particular scene you want to recreate is going to be during the Civil War. Maybe it's during the American Revolution. Maybe it's during the 1950s. But to do that, you can't just go in there with like hopes and wishes that I'm going to investigate and I'm going to try to interact with something from the 1950s. I'm going to try to investigate somebody from the 1860s. You've got to set the scene. Almost like a play. And so what he did at the tavern, and he's done this with CPRI at Bacon's Castle. But what he did was we set boundaries and rules. First off, nobody could go in during this investigation with any logos or, you know, common like today modern wear, you know, like something like this t-shirt would not have been allowed. So the very first thing is, how do you set the scene with yourself? And that is you take on the characteristics of that time period.
So you're basically making yourself a trigger item at that point.
Yes. So we asked all of our guests if they could either dress in 1860s garb or, like a button down, like something, you know, that would have been from a previous time, maybe like a thin flannel or something, right? No logos, nothing, some slacks and some nondescript shoes or boots, something like that. The second thing is technology. The biggest thing about investigating is everybody wants to go out and want to grab all their gadgets and just toss them everywhere. And it's like bingo. Like you're just like hoping something lands, right? But you've got to consider the idea that if you're investigating a location that has Native American history, the idea of using technology such as a flashlight, which today, you know, we consider this almost archaic form of light, right? Everybody uses this for flashlight now. Nobody like, I don't know that many people that actually carry around a flashlight anymore. We carry them around on investigations, but like if power goes out, what's the first thing you grab? Your phone, right? And so that technology that is so commonplace to us today could be considered like harmful, hurtful witchcraft, and things that they just don't understand. They can't comprehend. Therefore, it is scary. And so the second thing that we needed to focus on was how do we set the scene correctly? And so, you know, we couldn't use open flames because it's an old building, but we did use LED candles like the ones behind me. Any audio and video recording, we actually set up 4 hours in advance. And we tucked it away in corners of the room and like hid it. Like we covered it a little bit so that it wasn't so visible. Any audio recorders, any of that sort of stuff was tucked into corners, again, kind of like tucked away so they weren't as visible. And nobody was allowed to carry around flashlights or any cameras or anything like that. We used lanterns. So we've got the people and we've got kind of the location, the scene, that physical environment. Then we wrapped it up with smell. So we actually, part of this whole experience was we cooked dinner. And we went back and we found cookbooks from that time period. And we made a meal for everyone from that time period. So the tavern smelt like food from the 1860s, which you would have considered to be dinner. Then we had some folks playing music from that time period. Again, instruments from that time period, you know, music, a whole nine yards. Everything was lit by candles. We didn't have, you know, anything like electrically running that didn't simulate candles or candlelight. That's how we investigated.
So this is literally one giant trigger object.
Yeah. And so that's how we worked. And we worked our way through different scenes. And those scenes were different time periods, different layers of this onion, right? And so we worked our way from the American Revolution into the Civil War. And then we did a tiny bit past that, but we ran out of time for the evening because it's a pretty in-depth thing. But the activity that we were getting was amazing. I mean, we weren't just investigating the tavern. We were investigating the courthouse and the jail across the street. And what's really interesting is we tend to think of these locations being active only in that location, only in that building, right? We were seeing activity spike at the same time in the tavern as we were in the courthouse, as we were in the jail. So it wasn't just one localized experience in terms of these scenes. So for example, in one scene, we brought somebody in that was imprisoned from the jail. We took him from the jail to the courthouse. We sentenced him to death. And as the gavel banged on the podium, the folks that were experiencing this experiment in the tavern were hearing footsteps and talking and doors opening and closing. In the courthouse, as soon as we escorted the prisoner out, they're hearing footsteps and talking. We get to the jail. We walk this person up the steps. Now, at one point in the jail, when public executions were no longer allowed outside, this jail served as that location for public or for these executions, hangings. As we walked him up the steps to where they would have been executed and hung, we're hearing whistling, like Dead Man's Walk whistling from the cells. So we're hearing whistling, we're hearing talking, we're hearing all of this stuff, and it's not just one spot. We're getting this in three buildings, and there is a road separating the tavern from the other two. So like it's not like they're not within like earshot necessarily unless you're screaming. Like this is something systematic. This is something part of this environment so ingrained in that when we did something that would have occurred at this period of time in these sets of clothes, in these situations, we're spurring activity across the entire environment. Three buildings, not just one.
Do you think, like, because of that, like, being in the courtroom and doing that mock court case and all that stuff and then sending them over to jail, do you think that potentially what all the talking and walking around stuff might have been, like the lawyers and the judges and stuff like that and the jury that may have went from the courthouse over to the tavern afterwards to like have a drink and hang out?
Possibly. I mean, if somebody was there for court, it would have been circuit court and court day. That's the other thing to keep in mind. Court day is not the same as court day today. Court day today is like one of these things that you dread. And if you're lucky on your way into court, you don't get patted down incessantly. And it's just it's a somber, boring day, right? Like you are not excited. You're not excited to go to a court case, right?
I don't know.
Like who would be?
I don't know. I enjoy the pat downs.
I know you do. Yeah. So it's not the same as it is today. Court back in that time period, the time that we were working through, which is going to be like, you know, 1860s, a little bit later after the Civil War kind of deal. And even before that, circuit court came through once a month. And that was like the state fair. Like that is when you would go there, you would see your entire family. And you would consider this more of a festival than court. There would be horse racing outside. There would be music. People would bring wares to sell. They would bring their crop or, you know, food, anything, like literally anything that they wanted to sell, hang out. They'd set up vendors. They would see their family that they hadn't seen that entire month at circuit court day, right? In fact, it was so popular that not only did they have horse racing, but if court was in session, right? So everybody, all the lawyers, everybody and the judge is inside, and they know that a big race is about to occur outside, they would break from court. Everybody would walk outside, place their bets on their favorite horse. Then they would either win or lose, collect their earnings or their losses, and they would head back into court and continue. So it was like a big to do. It wasn't just this like, okay, the jury's here, the lawyer's here, the judge, the dude that, you know, did whatever. And that's it. It was a huge, huge thing.
I just imagine like in my head, like you're in the middle of a court case and like everyone walks out, but like the guy who's actually on trial, and he's like, well, shit, I can't do anything because, you know,
probably just had to stand there, chill out with these shackles. But yeah, I mean, it was a big thing. And so like people would be in and out of the tavern the entire time. And you've got to remember that public executions were a form of entertainment. Right. So like doing that wasn't seen as like this necessarily gory thing. They were like, oh, look at that. So like, I feel like this sentencing, this experience that we were trying to build, I feel like it could have been that where it's like, you know, the lawyers, the jury were heading to the tavern. I think it was more of like an uproar, like people were like getting really spurred. I wouldn't say excited, but like there was definitely, an elevation of like something's about to go down. It's the same thing as like you're sitting in your room at home and you hear an ambulance with its sirens blaring, driving down your road, and it stops across the street at your neighbor's house. Everybody will get up and stand at their window. And the brazen ones will open their front door and stand out on their porch. But people will stand there and watch no matter what. It's not exciting necessarily in the sense of like you're happy, but it is exciting in the sense that like you've got to see what's going on. Like something is happening. Something very serious is occurring. I need to go and watch. I need to go see what's up. And so you're going to go and watch, right? You're going to partake.
Yeah, unless you're trying to perform an SD session and, you know, everybody is outside screaming.
Kabam.
I mean, you know, not from experience or nothing like that.
No. But that's the idea. And so that's what I think, like some of these things where you're building and you're pulling back these layers, right? You're focusing on something very specific. You're not shotgun approaching your investigation. You are really tailoring it for a certain experience to try to communicate with somebody. If you subscribe to the notion that a ghost is a dead person, you know, somebody that once was alive and is now passed, that you are building out the level of comfort and trust and really investing in that relationship with that spirit so that they feel comfortable enough to come out and communicate with you. And what better way to do that than try to recreate the environment as to what they would have known it, what they would have been most comfortable in, versus just going in there, throwing out a bunch of equipment that they probably don't understand what it is or what it does. And there is no level of trust between you and that person. So why are they going to trust you when you say it's not going to hurt you, it's not going to harm you in any way, yada, yada, yada. I mean, I say that spiel. Like, I can rattle that off. I mean it, but that doesn't necessarily mean everybody's going to trust me or believe that, because I haven't built that relationship yet.
Well, I mean, it's natural for a human to not trust another human, even if they say, you know, oh, you can trust me. You know, it's sure. It's natural for us. But like going on that whole, you say reenactment, you don't like using that word, but, you know, and that reenactment, after that's said and done, can you reset? So like, let's use the tavern for example. You set it up for 1860s, you know, 1890s, whatever. After that couple hours is over, 3 hours, 4 hours, whatever, and you're ready to rock and roll, you still got your adrenaline up. Can you reset to the 1950s, to the Barksdale?
You need to wait.
You'd have to wait.
It's kind of one of those deals where it's like you've got to break down the scene and you've got to let the energy that has built up in that room kind of dissipate a little bit, because you're going to completely change everything and turn everything on its head. So that relationship, everything you built up with that one spirit, now all of a sudden you're standing there and the lights turn on and, you know, you're getting into your 1950s clothing. And now they're like, what the hell is going on? And so even the spirits that may have been there from the 1950s, or that's the time period that they claim to, they're confused too. So what John does, and I like this idea, is he will stop for a little bit, give it some time, let the room breathe, you know, everybody leave that environment, right? If you're going to change, you should be doing it somewhere where you're not part of the environment, because you want to go in there like it's a normal day, not like a specific day, not like D-Day, right? But something very specific to that time period, but would have been a normal day, right? So like D-Day, it's not a normal day, right? But leading up to it, you would have had normal days where you would have woke up in the morning, made yourself a cup of coffee, talked to your kids. Maybe at that time, you know, depending on the location, they were homeschooled. So you're going to talk a little bit about school, maybe mathematics, those sorts of things. That is a typical day in the life, not focusing on very specific things like the day that a very, you know, hellacious battle occurred, but something that is so mundane routine that like immediately I can connect with that. You know, I remember getting my kids ready for school. I remember getting up early and making myself this and getting ready for work. I remember doing this thing. Something that is just relatable.
I like that. I like setting up a scene and making one giant trigger, so to speak. We need to do more of that, Steve.
I want to. It's hard. It takes a lot of time and effort. That's the hardest part about it, is you actually have to prep for that. You have to do some serious work ahead of time. You have to build your scene. You have to find your actors and actresses, essentially, because you're really putting on a play almost. You're not really, like, in the sense of investigating, you're not there asking questions directly to anybody. You are acting and you're just hoping that the spirits there will also be part of your play. If you pertain to the ideas that ghosts were once living people,
so
then it's a phenomenal idea.
So going off of that, you know, if you believe that ghosts were living people, let's kind of jump around a little bit here. What says that during that production, you're not lining yourself up with maybe the 1860s that might still be going on in another universe?
Could be.
Makes sense.
You could be. So you're diving in again. You're going really hardcore. See, you're skipping a beat a little bit. So the idea, one of my favorite ideas in the paranormal, which is not terribly popular, but a lot of teams that are more scientific based do play around with this a lot. I know CPRI plays around with this quite a bit, but it's the idea of a multiverse, right? And so to do that, you have to walk into my existential crisis, and I can never pronounce that. But we all know that the universe started as one little tiny dot, right? One little infinitesimally small dot. And then something occurred that created the Big Bang, right? Like, we all know this. Yeah? You know this, Chris?
Well, I mean, if you think about it that way,
to science. Scientifically,
if you pertain to the religious side of things, then, God made heaven and heavens and earth and yada, yada, yada. So yes, if you go off the scientific thing, then yes.
No. Started with the Big Bang, Chris. You'd still believe in religion. I still believe in religion, but it was the Big Bang. That is how our universe started. And that is exactly why. So the Big Bang occurred and everything started rapidly expanding. Right. It was an explosion. I mean, take every Hollywood explosion you have ever seen on the big screen and just exponentially multiply that. You have the Big Bang. Right. And it is expanding so much so that today, as we live and breathe, our universe is still expanding. All right. The space and distance between our solar system and other solar systems, our galaxy and other galaxies, is actually expanding. And so like, think about that for a second. Today, you can look up into the night sky and you can see stars, right? You can see stars, and around each one of those stars, with most of them, have other planets surrounding them, right? They have their own little solar systems.
Theoretically.
You can see that today.
Theoretically. Because
we know that there are stars that are just like our sun, and they have planets that rotate around them. They have their own orbit.
Yeah, but by the time we see them, they're already burnt out.
Okay, possibly, not necessarily, because then we're talking about the speed of light, right? So we know that this, regardless of if we want to talk about like the crisis of being in the present and the fact that everything we see is history, everything that we experience and see external from our own brain is actually in the past, and the only form of present is in your brain, not even your eyes, because it takes time for energy to go from, or electricity to go from your eyes to register into your brain. So actually, we're all living in the past except for in that noggin of ours. So yes. It does take time for light to travel from a solar system, a planet, an external source, to our planet, and therefore into our eyes. But what we do know is that there are other stars out there, means there's other solar systems out there. But if you think about it, at some point in the future, it is going to be so far expanded that you will look out into the night sky and there will not be a single star except for our sun, because things are moving further and further and further and further away. At an accelerating speed right now. Just kind of crazy to think about. Now, it's not going to happen in our lifetime. It's probably going to happen very long from now, but it is occurring, and it's just something that's going on right this minute.
That's if the humans don't kill this planet before that time comes.
Well, probably, yeah. More than likely. But the idea is we are ever expanding. Our universe is expanding. And the interesting thing that I always... just baffles me is, what are we expanding into, right? Like, if you drop a droplet of water into a bucket, it hits the center of the bucket, and then it will kind of expand a little bit, right? But there are parameters to that bucket. You can only fill that bucket with so much water before it hits the sides, and then it starts filling up in a cylinder fashion, right? So what are we expanding into? Just nothingness? Like, it's so impossible to comprehend the vastness of our own universe as we understand it, but then add into the fact that it is expanding and we don't know what it's expanding into, just some void, some darkness. And somehow there was all this space where nothing existed before, and now we're taking up that space. Well, but is there a limit to that space?
What says that what we are expanding into might be another universe expanding also, and we end up colliding and causing another big bang?
You could. And so that's one of the ideas is, and that's one of my favorite ideas, is this idea that whatever we're expanding into, I liken our universe to a marble, right? And we are just one of many. We're not unique in the sense of a solar system. We know that just kind of within our own area, right? In our own galaxy, just for example, just to throw it out there, there are over 100,000 million stars in our galaxy, the Milky Way alone. All right. Around those stars, there's an estimated 100 billion planets.
Damn. Like, that's hard to wrap your head around.
So just take that for a second. And the idea of the whole Goldilocks zone, the idea that there are habitable planets that we're aware of within that number, we're not unique. Right. We know that just in our observable space, just in from our viewpoint, when we look up at the night sky from our little speck of dust that we call Earth, we can see an estimated 200 billion to 2 trillion galaxies. Wow. I would like to tell you the number, but I can't. I don't know how many planets that equates to, because I don't even know how to express it in a numerical format, but it is 1, 2, 3.
He is currently counting right now.
1 to the 25th degree.
Holy crap.
That is the amount of planets that we can observe from our tiny little speck within just our galaxy. So there's probably more, right?
Yeah.
So the idea that we are unique is a very pale idea, right? There has to be other life somewhere. And if you look at the idea that we're not unique, then why is our universe unique? Why do we have the right to say it's just our universe? There's not any other ones out there. So I like the idea of the multiverse because we're expanding, right? But are we going to expand into another universe? Are we just expanding, but we're kind of like one of these little marbles, and when we roll around in this cosmic bucket, we run into other marbles, and maybe at the right time and the right place, when we're doing that and we're late at night investigating, keeping in mind that the biggest reason we investigate late at night is to reduce noise and light pollution so we can see and hear things more clearly. Not that you need to investigate at night. It's just easier when you're investigating at a busy place. Maybe we are not necessarily experiencing spirits in the form of somebody that has once walked on this planet with us and has passed away, but maybe we are just bumping into that other marble, that other universe. And for a moment, one very brief moment, we are just as excited and startled that we are seeing or hearing or experiencing something as that alternate reality, that other universe is startled to be experiencing us.
I like that because, like, in the off chance that you do find like proof, or you know, if you come across like a full body apparition, something like that, and you know, the stories of, oh, it looked at me and it was, you know, it was shocked face and then it disappeared. What says that, like you said, this was, you know, a window that mm-hmm. we walked past and this thing walked past at the same time. And we were like, oh shit. Like, that's not supposed to happen.
Yes. And so we see cases of this in the paranormal. A good friend of mine, Alan Marston, had this happen to him at St. Albans Sanatorium. And that's an old insane asylum in Radford, Virginia. And as he was investigating, he was walking through one of the halls and he turns to look down a set of stairs. And as he does that and he pushes his flashlight in that direction, he illuminates a full-bodied apparition, what we would consider to be a full-body apparition, a person with a pig mask on, kind of like you see in Saw, right? So he knows that it's not this monster, right, with this pig head and like the body of a human, because he can see the cutout, and he can see the cutout where the eyes are, and he makes direct eye contact with this person. And Alan is startled, and his eyes get wide, and this individual is startled, and his eyes get wide. And then as this spirit, whatever we want to refer to it as it turns to rush back down the stairs where it came from, it disappears into a cloud of black smoke, right? So it's like, first off, you're like, a pig mask? Like, that's weird. That's some like American Horror Story vibes, right? but keep in mind that St. Albans has a haunted house every year, and they've had haunted houses for multiple years now. And they've had a pig mask dude in there. So could it be that there is some alternate universe where this individual is prepping or getting ready for haunt, because he was in fact walking up towards a section of the building that they use for haunt, and he was just as startled to see Alan standing there as Alan was to see him standing there.
But see, I kind of want to see it from like the pig mask guy's perspective, like him walk up the steps and see a guy standing there that, you know, I don't know what Alan was wearing, but you know, he's staring at this guy that's dressed 21st century. You know, I that's what I want to see, is like the other side of it, you know?
Sure. But if you're doing like a practice run, or maybe you're at the end or something, and you're just getting ready to head out or something, the likelihood of seeing a guest standing at the top of the steps, you know, that would still be startling. It's the same thing as like when I'm at the tavern and I lock up for the night. If I'm walking through the building, right, and as I come to the steps and I look up and there is somebody staring down at me, and I know the building's closed for the night, nobody's supposed to be in here, regardless of if it's a ghost or a living, breathing person, I'm going to be startled for a very quick second, right? Because I'm not going to expect somebody to be there. So I really feel it plays into the idea of this multiverse is like, why, if this entity is supposed to be the spirit, why is it startled of Alan and Alan is startled of it? Isn't it supposed to know, like, I don't know ghost law, but I feel like, you know, if you are haunting, quote unquote, a location, and you are moving about it, you know, the whole popular idea of like, can you make a sign? Can you show yourself to us? That would require a level of understanding of your surroundings, right? If you were to say, hey, can you make a knock? Can you make a sound? Can you show yourself to us? And these things occur. That means that there's a level of intelligence, right? There has to be to follow any set of commands. And second of all, a basic understanding of the environment, not necessarily omnipotence, but the idea that they know if they're going to show themselves to you, they have to know where you physically are.
Well, that's
so. That's why would it be startled?
That's if you look at it that way. I mean, you can also look at it as like when someone, let's just say someone passes on and they are haunting this place, to them, they're just going about their normal life. And we walk in and it's like strangers breaking into your house, you know? So could this possible entity also have been, you know, maybe a doppelganger of
blissfully ignorant of everybody else? I mean,
yeah.
I mean, Alan wasn't being quiet. He said that it was even on break, and his wife and kids were not far behind him. And they were talking loudly. They were on their way to the bathroom, I believe. You know, down in, and for those of you that know St. Albans, they were heading to that area of the building. So I say that because they were making noise. It wasn't like you had to be willfully ignorant if that was the case. Like just absolutely oblivious to everything around you. And then you just pop in. So it's kind of interesting, right? Like this whole idea of our spirits in that sense. And I'm not saying all pertain to this, but are they dead? And the idea of a multiverse, every action has and creates a new branch. So the idea of a multiverse also means that it needs to be unlimited. Every single thing that occurs creates a new branch. And for those of you that are huge Marvel fans, like myself, you should be experiencing something like this in the Marvel Cinematic Universe right now. Yeah, I am a nerd. That's okay. But there is a limitless amount of universes. There is one universe where you're not drinking water right now. You are drinking a Coke. There's another one where you're drinking a Pepsi. There's another one where 2 seconds from now, you will take a sip instead. There's a universe where, you know, we're both frogs having a Zoom call instead. There's so many different things that could be occurring. And so the idea to me behind that is like, if there are so many, and it is a truly limitless, and that's the idea of the multiverse, is everything, everything imaginable applies. There's a universe where time moves backwards, right? There's a universe where the laws of physics don't necessarily apply in the same way that they do here.
Well, that would mean that time is not man-made then. That time is not constructed by man.
Time is necessarily constructed by man. Time is a measurement, and a measurement is created by man. But in our definitions of it, but time is, and that's a whole other section of what is a ghost. Great, great catch, Chris. So you've got your multiverse idea, right? And so the idea being there is that we're not necessarily interacting with the dead. Maybe we are interacting with the past. Maybe we are actively, presently interacting with the past. In such a way that we are brushing up against that reality for the briefest of seconds, and we get a quick glimpse into it, just like they get a quick glimpse into ours. The other idea that I love is the idea of alternate dimensions, right? So time's a great idea, right? Time is this measurement, right? And humans, we live in a dimensional world. Do you know how many dimensions we live in?
In theory,
the understanding of humanity as it is today.
Three dimensions, but in reality, it's four.
Good, Chris. Yeah. Rubbing off. Yeah. So we live and understand our environment as a four-dimensional reality, right? Technically, it's three spatial dimensions. Which is height, width, and depth, and then one temporal dimension or vector, which is time. Now, we say that time is a vector because humans at this point can only experience time in one way. And to us, as we understand it, time moves forward. That's not necessarily true, but that is just how we understand it, right? And so we need all of these things to identify other things, right? I can say that I myself am at a very specific three-dimensional place. I am in my office at home, sitting at my desk, but I require time to know when I am sitting here. When we're done with this, call, I will probably not be at my desk in my chair. I will be somewhere else, probably reading a book to my daughter. So we require time as a description of the other vectors, or excuse me, of the other dimensions, so that we can properly describe something. we can't describe Steve without saying a specific time, because if we say Steve is there, well, that's great. But when am I there? I am there at specific times. I'm not always there. So the idea that we understand the world in which we comprehend is four-dimensional for all sakes and purposes, right? But what if there's more than that, right? What if there's more? What if there is more? All right. And so one of the most interesting things, and I've taken it from this book right here. It is The Ghost Studies. It's by Brandon Masullo. It's a great book. It's a great read to really start diving into this really weird why question. But out of that, I learned about a world-renowned physicist by the name of Mikio Kaku. And Mikio once proposed an interesting statement. Let's say that a 10-lane superhighway is being built next to an anthill. And you've heard this before, Chris.
Yeah, I love this.
Would the ants know what a 10-lane superhighway is? Do they comprehend, or can they comprehend what it is, what its use is? Can they communicate with the workers who are literally mere feet away and building this highway? And furthermore, would they even be aware of its presence? Would they know in their whole comprehension of the world and everything around them that feet from there, this massive construction is underway for a 10-lane superhighway as a medium for people to move?
Steve, I'm going to stop you right there. I think that is a perfect stopping point for part one. So what I'm going to do is leave everybody on a cliffhanger, and they will have to listen for next week's episode for part two on, can an ant comprehend a superhighway that is beside an anthill? So I want to thank y'all for listening. If you're enjoying the show, be sure to follow us and stay tuned for more episodes to come. And Steve, thank you for part one, and I will see you in part two.
Let's talk about ants.